Hello, I'm Greg Johnston. Welcome to Imagining the Past, the summertime season 2023, and the reading is easy. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water and community. We pay respects to elders past, present and emerging. In this podcast series, we'll be hearing some of the sessions from the 2021 HNSA conference. The Historical Novel Society Australasia promotes the reading, writing, and publishing of historical fiction through our biennial conferences and online programs. The ARA Historical Novel Prize is now the richest genre-based literary award in Australasia, a breathtaking $100,000. Divided between the adult and CYA categories. In this session, Renee Otmar discusses Writing the Other with Rachel Binsale, Tim Darcy Ellis, and Indrani Ganguly, why questions of representation and appropriation matter, and whether respectful research is the answer to successfully writing the other.
I'm Renee Otmar. I started my professional career as an editor about 32 years ago, back in 1989. But I've been a writer for a long time and a reader for even longer. I started reading my mother's Mills and Boone in the toilet when I was about 9 years old. And in the years following, I found Jane Austen and the Bronte sisters and so on. And so historical fiction is my go-to comfort read. And I emigrated to Australia from apartheid South Africa, so I appreciate very deeply that these lands we call Australia were never ceded. And to this end, I pay my respects to the First Nations elders and traditional owners, past and present, where I am today, which is Wadawurrung country, and also where you are. I extend a very warm welcome to any First Nations people joining us here today, and I appreciate your presence and your input. So given the context of this session, I'd like to share with you that I identify as a Black woman and a writer of colour. And if you're looking at my skin tone and you think about calling me mixed race or biracial or coloured or any of those kinds of terms, because that's what you've heard about South Africans who look like me, please keep in mind that I reject the notion of race and I find those terms hurtful and offensive. So with that out of the way, in this session, we're interested in whether an author should only write within the boundaries of their own experience or gender or sexual orientation or cultural background, and how this might influence the work of historical novelists who must also avoid imposing our contemporary biases on characters from different historical periods. I'm expecting to have today with us three exceptional writers. Rachel Binsale is hopefully going to be with us very shortly. She's over in the far north of Western Australia. Is Broome far north Western Australia? Very far away from where I am indeed. And I really hope that she can join us today because she has a very, very interesting perspective that I think you would find. I think this is this. No, it's not. That's not Rachel. Hello. But I also have with me Tim Darcy Ellis and Indrani Ganguly, who are going to tangle with this notion of writing the other and reflecting on why questions of representation and appropriation matter. Hello, Diane. thanks for joining us. Are you giving us...
Sorry, I'm not sure how this has happened. Apologies for that.
Oh, you're a guest. All right. Sorry. Welcome. And we'll just keep going. I was hoping that she had some news for us about Rachel, but hopefully she will join us very shortly. So Tim Darcy Ellis is a former professional archaeologist. His critically acclaimed debut, which is called The Secret Diaries of Jean-Louis Vives, is this beautiful cover. It's a fast-paced and meticulously researched historical novel, which I absolutely adored. Tim is passionate about bringing his love of history, archaeology, and philosophy together and to express it by writing great fiction. Welcome, Tim.
Thank you, Renee. It's lovely to be here.
And Indrani Ganguly was born of Bengali-speaking parents in Lucknow, India, and migrated to Australia in 1990. Her publications, comprising both academic and creative works, include In My Father's House from 2015, and a historical novel, The Rose and the Thorn, which was published in 2019. And this focuses on so-called ordinary women in India's national movement and social reform. And Indrani is now working on the sequel to continue the story in post-independent India and some Australia-India connections, which I think will be quite fun. So I have a series of questions and topics I'd like to talk with our panelists about, and then we'll save the last 10 to 15 minutes for questions from you, from the audience. So you can post your questions using the Q&A function. Don't put them in the chat because I find them quite distracting, and the Q&A function is for that purpose. I won't look at that until it's Q&A time, but feel free as questions come to mind to pop them in there, and then I will choose the best ones there and present them to our lovely panelists. So when Rachel joins us, I'll stop proceedings briefly to introduce her, but we're going to keep going because we only have this really short time together, and I'd love to make the most of it. So Tim is joining us today from Sydney, the newly freed capital of New South Wales.
That's right.
I must confess that, and I showed this gorgeous cover, I totally judged this book by its cover when it first arrived in the post. I completely fell in love with it, and I knew I was going to love reading the book. And I have to say, a pretty wild ride from the confines of my lounge room. So, Tim, I'll start with you. You dedicated your book to Nancy Rice Saunders, and that was that intrigued me. So would you tell us who she was?
Yeah, Nancy was my step-grandmother, and she passed away with COVID at the age of 99 last year, just before the book was published. And because she'd made such a positive impact on my life and the life of so many other people, I wanted to dedicate the book to her. And just a little bit about her life in a nutshell. She came from a very middle-class English family, and she had a fiancé from a very middle-class Scottish family, and she fell in love with my grandfather, who was a Jewish man and a widow with five orphan children under the age of 10. They were his children. His wife, my grandmother, had passed away. And my stepmother, Nancy, abandoned everything and was rejected by her family, and came and basically took care of these five children with a completely different culture that she embraced. New family, and had four more children of her own, and you would never have known that she treated any of them any differently. The whole nine of them were treated just like hers, and the grandchildren were treated just like hers. So I thought it was fitting at that time to dedicate the book to Nancy. Yeah.
She sounds absolutely gorgeous, and I'm going to suggest that there might be another book about her. Now, I'm so thrilled that Rachel Binsala has joined us. I understand you've been dueling with internet gremlins from Broome.
I'd like to say I was in Broome yesterday, but now I'm in Perth.
You get around. Well, you're very, very welcome. I'd like to very briefly introduce you, Rachel, and then I will continue. We just really started, so I'd love to show people this beautiful book that you wrote. So Rachel Binsala is descended from Nimanbur and Yawuru peoples of the Kimberley. Rachel's passionate about First Nations peoples telling their stories. And in 2014, she became publisher at Magabala Press and wrote her first book, Alfred's War, which was published in 2018 and reissued in 2019. It is an absolutely stunning book, gorgeous illustrations, and we will get to that hopefully later. So welcome, Rachel. So back to Tim, if you don't mind. So Thanks for telling us about Nancy. I just think that that's such a fascinating story. So could you tell us about your first encounter with the story of Jean-Louis Vide and how you came to write the book?
Well, I completely came across him by accident. I'd been researching my family history, as many people do, and I think it's probably only of interest to the family of origin. And they were Sephardi Jews. They came from Spain, Italy, Portugal, through Holland and then into England. And at the same time, I bought a friend a book called The Exiles, who was Spanish, and it was basically about the exiles who had been forced to leave Spain through history. And when I buy someone a book, I usually read half of it first, which is a bit cheeky, but it's just what I do. And I just thumbed to the index Jewish exiles and came across Juan Luis Vives and his incredible story of being born in the year that Jews were expelled from Spain in 1492, and the extraordinary journey that he had through life of escaping Spain, of moving to Paris, France, and England. And he was a pacifist and a humanist and a champion of education for all classes, education for women. He was the first person to write about the education of women in Renaissance Europe. Advocated for a national health service paid for by the state, care of the mentally sick and as well as the physically sick, and a kind of League of Nations. And he was greatly outspoken against the Inquisition and authority of the warring sort of empires of Renaissance Europe. And so I felt that someone must have written some fiction about him, even if it was in Spanish. There must be a film about him, even if it was in Spanish. And to my surprise, there was no fiction about him. And I think it's because he sort of fell through the gaps of history of sort of denying his Judaism in public, but practicing Judaism in secret. But I thought that this was a really, you know, there's a lot of nitty gritty to this story, and that I really had this urge to write his story in his words, which is why I wrote it in the first person, in the form of a diary that's found in the modern era. So it was really, I came across him by chance, but as soon as I did, I felt it was my mission to write his story.
Yeah, and you certainly do that in a very, very compelling way. Thank you. So back to Rachel, as joining us from Perth. Rachel, congratulations on producing this, what I think is an extraordinary and beautiful book with the illustrator Samantha Fry, Alfred's War. So could you tell us about how important it is for young children to read the story about Alfred and what you're hoping to convey to them through this story?
I think a lot of it has to do with, in a sense, how I grew up. So my dad is Malay Aboriginal, and he grew up in a pearling town, and my mum is originally from Northern Ireland. So I and my father and my mum kind of like have experienced Broome as always being the other, so you're always outside of history. And when I was growing up, I don't know if it's an old school mentality, but a lot of adults seem to think that children won't understand complex subjects. And, you know, and you don't tell them, or you not necessarily convey the truth in so many ways. And I can remember my dad trying to tell me the story or the history of our family and, you know, his brothers that were taken away and, you know, the ones who had died and stuff like that. And he always said to me, oh, you're too young. And then I said, no, tell me. And then he told me, and I remember sitting in the car thinking, is that it? You know what I mean? Like this horror story and I'm this child.
Oh, he's trying to protect you from.
Yeah, you know, and I remember sitting there slightly being insulted that he wouldn't think that I could get it. So I think children have agency, and I think they're way more intelligent than we give them credit for. And I think if we can tell them the truth in such a way that they can make their own minds up, you know, and the best form of power, you know, as humans that we have is that the self-realization about certain things. And that's why I wrote about Alfred's War, and I mainly wrote it about not necessarily because I myself don't have that truth in my family about a family member, especially an Indigenous one going to war, but I have the truth in my family about the experience of coming back from war and, you know, civil rights. you know, and what's fair and what's not fair. So that's why I wrote it.
Interesting. When we first met, you told me that your work was so, or is so tied up with helping people from marginalised communities to find their voice that you didn't think you had anything to say, which I thought was really intriguing. So how did you discover that, in fact, you do have quite a lot to say?
It's because I've worked in publishing for so long, and I facilitate, or sort of is similar to being a midwife, you know, with people and their stories and making sure that the creative process is suitable for the individual, you know, and especially in marginalised community where there's lots and lots of trauma in some ways, so you have to make space for that. What was the question?
How you found it? Really, it's about how you found your own voice in the process of giving voice to others.
I actually don't know, because I always thought I would never write because I actually had nothing to say. And then one day I found out that I had a lot of rage. So I just tapped into that.
Yeah.
You know, and it was like, oh, I think I've got something to say on that subject. So I sat down and I wrote about it, and that was what happened with Alfred's War.
Oh, good on you. There is something good to come out of rage. Thanks. Now to Indrani. Indrani is joining us today from Brisbane. Are you still in Brisbane, Indrani?
Yeah.
Terrific. So your novel is a story about two identical twins, and to say that is true, but it doesn't touch on the extraordinary setting of the story in pre-independent India. So could you tell us about what inspired you to take on this challenge of writing a story with the backdrop of such sweeping social and political reform in India at that time?
Well, basically, I'm trained as a sociologist and a historian, and my area of specialization is modern India. So, but when I was looking for a topic for my thesis, my professor said, look, there's heaps written on the big cities. Why don't you look at what's happening in the smaller urban centers? And you're in a prime position because your mother's family comes from a small town which was ruled by big landlord, and you know, there's all the dynamics of how he negotiated with the British and how the ordinary Indians. So anyway, I head off there, and I was doing the research, and I was aware that in the period 1900-1947 there were two concurrent movements happening in India. There was the movement for independence, but there was also a lot of social reform movements, because we our leaders and people recognized that we had many forms of what we call internal colonization. And so you had to fight on both fronts. I could find quite a lot of documented information on the prominent figures, both male and female, but I couldn't find anything on the so-called ordinary people, male or female. Mm-hmm. And it was just a chance conversation with my maternal grandmother, to whom I was very close and I was staying with. And I said, oh, you weren't involved in any of this? And she said, yes, I was. Not so much in the national movement, because I hate spinning, because that was part of the, but she was very involved in setting up self-help groups for widows who had no form of employment or ways of sustaining themselves. And that's actually reflected in part of the story. The other bit, I couldn't use that for my thesis, and neither could I use some of the stories my grandfather told me about all these rather unconventional relationships that were happening under the surface of what is a very conservative society. Mm. But I tucked those ideas away in my head and wrote a short story when I came to Australia, and called The Rose and the Thorn. And my writer friend said, look, got the makings of a novel that started the journey.
Thank you.
But it's not about my family or me or anyone, which has disappointed some of my readers, but it just draws on.
Well, there's still time, isn't there? I've been very interested in writing and research on subconscious bias for a while now, and it's a topic I often discuss with students in my editing courses. I'm really aware of the racial and paternalistic biases that skew the curriculum when I was growing up. And pretty much everything that I learned about the history of South Africa when I was growing up was outside the classroom. So I'm interested in Indrani in particular. You've lived, as you say, you were born in Lucknow. You've lived in different parts of India and as well in Australia. So what were you taught about Indian history and culture while growing up?
Well, India was a bit different from South Africa and Australia in that it was never a settler colony. It was a colony from which resources were extracted. It's not as anywhere as old as Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander culture, but it is still an old civilization with many people coming in and a long tradition of history, of recorded history from both the Hindu and the Muslim and the whole range. So that couldn't be obliterated as it was, you know, here. I grew up in independent India where the curriculum was set by the Indian government. So the history and culture were very much part of the curriculum. This didn't mean that we learned nothing about the outside world. I read Enid Blyton and Biggles and all that along with all the Indian and other nations. And my parents were also quite well aware, though they grew up under the British, and yes, they would have been presented with a somewhat sanitized view of the British occupation of India, but they knew what was happening before that. So there was all that. Growing up in different parts of the country was also a good appreciation of diversity, because each of the states is formulated around a major language. Mm. And because we have a three language policy, so Hindi, English, and whatever the state language. Now, I couldn't learn a different language every 2 or 3 years. I can't even read most of it, but we at least appreciated. But we were aware that there were all these facets of the culture. Of course, as in every country, the history is often the history of those in power, and the history of the more marginalized groups has become more evident as, you know, different groups gain access to ways of expressing them. So I learned much more about it in university, particularly the histories of the different First Nations people, because not many people know that outside India know that over 8% of the population is different First Nations. That's over 100 million people, very diverse.
Yes. I mean, it's fascinating, and I think that, personally, that's my view that, you know, the history we were taught we should be aware of, where, you know, what motivated the kind of history that we're taught, because as writers, this is, you know, informing to a great extent our work and our approach. So I wondered about our other two panelists. Rachel, what about you? Would you share with us the sort of history you were taught at school and at home?
So I grew up in Broome, and we have a very strong local history, and that's based around the pearling industry and the pastoral industry to a certain extent. And all of these industries were really based on government policies of the time, you know, where Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders sat in the scheme of things and how we were governed. So these were probably the only industries in some ways that we could go into, or we were co-opted into, or we were forced into in lots of different ways. When I was at school and growing up, I didn't see any representation at all anywhere, not even when we did reading for English, about any Aboriginal history as such. Because my mum is an avid reader, and she's from the north, so I grew up with lots of Oscar Wilde and lots of English poets, Enid Blyton, Rumour Godden, because she travelled to India when they immigrated to Australia, so she had that connection there, and she loved that. So when I grew up, I actually, far as we were concerned, like I knew who I was, but didn't once see it reflected back. So my mum took me to meet her family in Ireland. I think I was about 19. And when I was over there, and they said to me, "Oh, you're Australian." And I just said, "No, I'm not." Do you know what I mean? Like, that was just an affront, because marginalised people don't see themselves anywhere. So when you don't have representation. Technically, in some ways, you don't exist. And, you know, and these are the things children tell themselves, you know. So it is subliminal messaging from a very, very young age that, you know, gets carried into adulthood, you know, and into policy making and politics, and affects every part of life in general.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, so that's our my history.
Yeah, look, I mean, Rachel, you and I and Indrani, we share a common experience of being born in a country with a history of British colonisation, and that obviously sets the agenda for, or set the agenda for our education and specifically our history curriculum. But what history was taught to the children of the colonisers? Now, Tim, you're the last person I would characterise as a coloniser, but can you share with us what history you were taught as a child in England and how the history of empire was conveyed?
Well, I guess history hung on the shoulders of the monarchs, and it was really began with William the Conqueror. And before that, you know, the Æthelstans and the Canutes and the Harthacnutes Canutes really, like, they didn't count. It really sort of began in 1066. And then it was William the First, William the Second, Richard the Lionheart, etc., up to Henry the Eighth. And
I bet you can recite them all.
Oh, I could go through the whole thing and their dates and their wives and everything, because I was, you know, that kind of obsessive compulsive child, and I pored over the history books and memorized it, and my grandfather would come and tell me the wives of Henry the Eighth when I was about five, you know, and I'd go through the whole thing. But I think it was very, very limited approach, because what was going on with the 98% of people that never get to the historical record. But by the same token, it does help me to understand what was happening in 1350 compared to what was happening in 1620. So I have quite a good sort of framework in my mind. Mm. And beyond that, it was the great movements of people, such as the Romans going on into the Saxons, the Norman invasion, and who were the Vikings. But very much from and I had mentioned this earlier when we were talking, the viewpoint that really God is an Englishman, you know, really that the English had the answers to the world's problems, if only the rest of the world would see it that way. And that the colonization was actually a good thing because we beat other people who weren't so good to it. And then that sort of leapt ahead to the point where you're learning about the great heroes like Elizabeth Fry, you know, in terms of her contribution to prison reform, you know, William Wilberforce to deconstructing slavery, and Florence Nightingale, you know, starting to look after people on the battlefield. So, you know, deconstructing those systems that the colonialism had created. But very little, I mean, we did learn about the black hole of Calcutta, but that was probably about the only thing that we learnt about, what was happening in India at the time, and a bit about the Zulus in South Africa. Yeah. But you had to dig deep to find the other voice in that, and what was it like for immigrant communities in England at the time? Right. You know, what was it like for religious minorities? What was it like for people, you know, sexually diverse people? And then people with you know, gay people, what was life like for them? That really did not come into it. And so, you know, one really had to dig deep for that. And also the concept of what is an English person, and looking, you know, more recently, I suppose, into the DNA of what that means is kind of, you know, where one of my interests lies as an archaeologist as well.
I think that's an absolutely fascinating discussion. And I want to keep this conversation going. I'm going to go to another topic, and we can loop back to that at some stage. But Rachel, a theme that stands out to me in your book is one about perceptions of people who do not live in conventional homes. So Alfred, in your story, chose a solitary life in which his home isn't constructed of wood or bricks and mortar, but rather the entire continent and all the skies above him. So were you thinking about this setting as a way to represent someone urban Australians might think of as homeless?
It's quite... I originally wrote, because I was travelling to Melbourne a fair bit for work, and in the cities mainly, like we do have community people that come into Broome all the time, and they know people, so they come and go. In that sense, you know, so they always have family or they have connection. So when I went to Melbourne and Sydney to see the sheer amount of homeless people sleeping on the streets in the main city urban areas, and especially as a first world country like Australia, it was kind of like, what are we doing? You know, where are our priorities? You know, in terms of mental illness and whatever circumstances happened, you know. And that's what got me to thinking about what's acceptable for a person of colour to be homeless. You know, what's acceptable in Australia for a person of colour to be homeless? And the only, so it sort of went on from there. So a person of colour to be homeless in Australia would have to probably be a war veteran, because that's the type of noble endeavour with the diggers, you know, that we as a nation aspire to. So how does an Aboriginal person be homeless in that sense? So that's kind of like where Alfred came from. And also to talk to the stereotype that's happening in Australia at the moment in and around Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander identity, that, you know, individuals are well-placed within a community. And in terms of the stolen generation, you know, a lot of individuals don't have connection. So this also talks to the stereotype subliminally that's happening in Australia with what mainstream publishing is looking at as well, that all Aboriginal people are in touch with the land and country, you know, and their feelings. So that was mainly why I did that as well.
Yeah, I felt that was a really such an interesting point. And I wonder now, if you were to be wandering the very empty streets of Melbourne, how that, you know, how you would look back to that time when you saw so many homeless people in Melbourne. But I'm conscious of the time, and we do want to have some questions for our audience. Tim has disappeared, but I'm going to keep going. So I actually have a question that for all three of you. Oh, no, sorry. This next question I had was for Tim. So let me just keep going, because I've got a few here. Indrani, in your foreword, which I really enjoyed, I'm one of those people who reads acknowledgements and forewords and prefaces and things, because I like the backstory. And in your foreword, you talk about how you approach the presentation of dialogue between your characters. And you say, I've never liked the way Indian characters speak in books and films authored by Westerners. So can you tell us why that is?
Yeah, I should probably correct it to add some Indians as well, because what they often do is do a direct transliteration. The characters are not speaking in English, they're speaking in whatever their first, whether it's Bengali or Hindi or any of a whole range of. So when you transliterate, it sounds very peculiar in English, and I think it distracts. It often sounds like a caricature. So I just was talking about this to an Indian, and she said, oh, just write what is true to the heart. What you'll end up writing is Indian English. You're not going to be writing in Australian English or British English. And I ended up doing that. And I did get a wide range of people to read it. And not many people commented on the language, except for one Anglo-Australian. He said, oh, Indrani, I liked everything, but the language is very old-fashioned and it's not Australian English. And I said, well, it's 1900 to 47, so even Australian English would be old-fashioned. And they're in India, most of them will be speaking in Bengali or Hindi. Some of them would have been speaking in English as well. And I tried to avoid slipping too much into another language, which is how we speak, but then it's hard for someone who doesn't know those languages to.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That's the reason.
Tim, you disappeared there for a second. Oh. I wondered, but I'm glad you're back. I wondered how you approach dialogue in the writing of your book.
Well, I wanted to make it fast-paced. It was really was a goal of mine to.
It's edge of your seat, people.
Yeah, not lose the reader, and I loved you know, I like Dickens because it's fast paced. I like Armistead Maupin because he's fast paced, and he wrote, you know, they wrote for Chronicles, and I don't know if everyone's watched Babylon Berlin on Netflix, which is a German series that was a cartoon that was made into a TV series. So I really loved that fast paced action, and I wanted to bring the other characters to life through their dialogues and to give each of my characters very much an individual voice. So it wasn't all about Juan. It wasn't all about his story. It was also about his companion, Alvaro de Castro, who comes to me mind like a 16th century Jewish James Bond into the action, and the loves in Juan's life. You know, he was in love with two women at the same time and very conflicted by that. And so I just wanted to bring their voices into the dialogue, because I think with first person, especially something that's diarized, it can become verbose and it can become a little bit just one-sided. And so I really wanted to bring those other characters into the action and not to lose the reader.
Yeah, you absolutely do. I have a very long list of questions, but this is not about me. I have also some questions here from our audience who is really enjoying this sparkling conversation, quote, sparkling. So I'm going to go to some of the questions that have come up. Oh, there's quite a few here. I think, okay. Rob McLaren asked if there's a list of general principles or questions that allow a writer to test if their narrative or characters are culturally offensive or inappropriate. If not, where can a writer find guidance? Mm-hmm. Would like to interrupt. Sorry, Rachel, would you like to take that?
look, that is a really huge question. I think the best thing to do is interrogate your motives as to why you're doing it and what the type of representation that you're moving through. I think it is so very hard because what happens if you don't know anybody from that particular cultural background, or you have no knowledge of it, or you may have done lots and lots of research? What happens is we still have unconscious bias. You know, some books that I have read by non-Indigenous creators that have Indigenous characters, unless you're involved in the life or you are, you can tell where they're coming from is by the unconscious bias, but also by the nuances. So some books are much better than others, you know, and you need to be careful with how you approach things and also who you ask, because that is a big cultural load to be able to ask somebody from what you're writing about to be able to give you feedback, because they themselves might not know. You know, you're asking someone to speak for everybody. Right. So there's always going to be mistakes, you know, in that regard. So, and as long as you're not in a rush, I think that's the most important thing, and to read widely and diversely of the subject matter that you're writing about. I think that's really important, and allow that knowledge to become background, the white noise at the back. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? So it's unconscious and you know it.
Absolutely. And this might be a good point to put in a plug too for professional editors. I think a good professional editor can assist you in that regard, in which communities to approach and so on. Another question here we have from Helen, which says, thank you for sharing such important experiences and discussions. As someone who has grown up with disabilities or chronic conditions, as well as ADHD and anxiety, I'm wondering what the panel's thoughts are about writing from the voice of characters with disabilities, mental illness, and neurodiversity from an historical lens. Great question.
Oh, just do it. we need to hear more voices. We need to hear different points of view. You know, I think it's really important. You know, the best books that I have read of authors, in a sense, have been where English is not their first language. Mm-hmm. Because their first language, they're brought up in it, so they think differently. They think with the language. So to translate or to write in English, in a sense, it's a completely different way of thinking. Mm-hmm. And it is so important, you know, and if that's who you are and that's your point of view, do it.
Yeah, thank you. This is actually a really nice segue to a question for Indrani from Jackie, who says, did you have a lot of readers tell you that they expected the story to be in Hindi, and how did you blend the terms without losing the modern day reader who wants to learn?
No, not Hindi, because that's why I specify that I'm from a Bengali speaking background. I do speak read and write Hindi, and English is my third language, but all my education was in English. So we have that. No, I didn't have that. In terms of blending it, because we grew up speaking all three languages, depending on who we were speaking to. So I just wrote the way I interact in everyday life. I wouldn't use Bengali if there wasn't a Bengali speaking person, and I don't know any of the South Indian or other Indian languages. As I said, we have all the First Nation languages, and only 8 of them are in a written form at present. But what's really exciting is they're inventing their own or creating their own script, but I still would not use it.
Yeah.
So I just wrote the way we speak in everyday.
Thank you. So maybe this question could go to Tim. What if you're writing from an era that no longer exists, say a biblical era? Could you write as a Hebrew male, or would that not be okay?
I think it's about doing as much research as you possibly can and talking to as many people as you possibly can. And then gathering that information. So I think if about doing my objective research, which is obviously going to be reading, and so much easier now that we have the internet and I can access academic articles and journals, and then I can approach academics, I can approach people from those communities. So, you know, there still are Spanish and Portuguese Jewish communities throughout Western Europe, in London, Amsterdam, and other parts of the world as well. So, I mean, I feel like I need to approach as many people as possible, gather all the research that I can in the objective way. And then I do some kind of, try and do some sort of spiritual work with that as well. You know, some quiet times, so some meditation, and just sit with it, knowing that I might not be connecting with anything spiritual at all, but feeling that, you know, that I've done my bit to be as authentic as I can and to pay enough respect to those people past and present in the culture that I'm writing about. And then I have to write, you know, because I could be stuck in that, you know, it could be like a writer's block thing that I could be stuck in for years, thinking that I'm not going to sound authentic enough and that somebody is going to take issue with my viewpoint on this topic. But I feel if I've done it justice in terms of my objective, subjective, and spiritual work on it, then I can. Then I'm in a position to write, and I'm happy with what I'm writing. But then also, obviously, in the editing stage, like you said, Renee, you know, getting feedback from editors is just invaluable. And you're sort of your beta reader group, you know, having 4 or 5 people that will read the work and then give you, not just, you know, because you're the friend, they tell you your work is fantastic. You need people that are going to tell
they're
you
what obliged, what, right? You know, yes.
As well as what is. And I think as a writer, that's always like, oh, no, you know, but actually that's just part of the deal. You know, we have to accept that kind of feedback.
Good point. Now, we've got 3 minutes left of our session, and this is going to cut off automatically in 3 minutes. So I'm going to ask a question, and just if you could answer it really quickly until we get cut off. But before we do that, I want to thank you, Rachel and Tim and Indrani, for your participation today, for your generosity in responding to, you know, quite interesting questions. I'd love to continue this, but we have a short time. So the final question, I think, is going to be this. Do questions of representation matter? Is it important that Indrani should have Indian heritage, or Rachel should have an Indigenous heritage, or for Tim to be Jewish, to ensure authenticity and respect in the stories? We'll start with you, Rachel.
If I'm writing about Indigenous topics, yes, it is important in that sense, only because I know from my experience only the nuances. I also wouldn't talk about a First Nations person from another area, because completely different geography, completely different cultural, you know, dynamics and all of that stuff as well. but who I am and my experiences inform how I may go forward in regards to what I write about as well. So, and it depends on the subject matter completely.
Yeah. Actually, before the other two, I was racing ahead. The cutoff time is 3:45, so we have loads of time. I was thinking, God, the time has gone so quickly. So we have 15 minutes. Please take your time. I have heaps of questions, and there are still some questions in the Q&A. Phew.
Rachel, have you finished?
This question.
Yes, I'll go for it.
Patient, yes, yeah. Indrani, please go ahead.
Well, Indian heritage, it depends on which Indian. Like Rachel, I wouldn't go to an area where I didn't speak the language or could, because even though Hindi is not my first language, I can read in it, I can speak in it. And so I could use sources that wouldn't be available if I only had English. Mm-hmm. And I thought, especially for these groups of women, it's often the letters or the little journals they produce or they write. And there are some pretty good novelists in both Bengali and Hindi, which have not yet been translated into English. So I think I'm a bit nervous also about writing about people where there's no sort of in-depth, some kind of in-depth connection, you know, where you're just the kind of object of that, of that whatever you're writing.
So just to follow on that, Indrani, Jenny asked a question that's relevant. Is it better to stick to plain English for all characters where you're writing a novel set in a country with multiple ethnicities? So to use plain English despite everyone's ethnicity so that you avoid mistakes or stereotyping? What's your thinking?
Yes, I mean, you can use the odd word also, but not too much.
Mm. Yeah. Thank you.
Because after all, English has also taken in words from other languages, which have become part of the English vocabulary. And sometimes, it's often good to get someone who knows both languages to read it.
Yeah, good point. Thank you. So, Tim, for you, questions of representation. Yeah.
I think it's a really fascinating topic because, I mean, I think on the one hand, if a writer is non-Jewish, non-male and wants to write about a Jewish character, who is anybody to stop them doing that? But I think it would really pay them dividends to do as much research about the traditions that they were writing about. Not all Jewish people are the same. What part of the world did they come from and what was their sort of relevant culture at the time? And I think also to outreach to relevant Jewish book councils and book societies and reading clubs and book clubs and doing as much sort of respectful connectivity work as is possible. But I don't see any barriers really to someone who's done that work to writing about a Jewish male character if they're not Jewish and don't identify as male. You know, but interesting at the same time, would I want to write first person Aboriginal Australian? I would feel unworthy of that. And it would probably hold me back. And would I be able to do enough research and do enough outreach work in order to be able to do that? And just the practical aspect of that is not. So I'll probably stay within my own sort of, you know, classification, my category and my genre for the next couple of books. But then perhaps, you know, as time allows, to diversify beyond that.
Yeah. Both you, Tim and Rachel, have touched on this point of, you called it outreach, Tim. This is making connections with the communities that are perhaps, you know, represented in your characters or in your setting and so on. I also, in my work as an editor, hear that many communities are kind of overrun with, you know, people wanting this kind of input. And sometimes people see it as a way of getting their work kind of endorsed, and other times they genuinely want, you know, to get that perspective. How do we avoid taxing communities that, you know, may already be they don't have the time, they're busy working on their own issues? Why should they all make time? Should they be paid? Or how could this work for both parties rather than just the kind of the one way?
I think it's about being of service to that community in some way. You know, what can I give first? And the law of reciprocity will will work. And I think rather than what can I take from you, what can I learn from you? And that comes across when you're just driving at something, when you're aiming to get something like a sort of news story hungry journalist, as opposed to how can I, and of course journalists have their role, you know, we need journalists, I'm not decrying that, but I think how can I be of service to this community? So if I was writing about Aboriginal character from Redfern, which is very close to where I live here, how can I be of service to that Aboriginal community first and learn, you know, side by side? I think that's how I would try and approach that.
Nice. Rachel?
It is a really hard one, I think, and with marginalised communities that have been on the fringes for a really long time and they are working on their own issues. It is about trust and it is about time. And if an individual or has time to be able to form true friendships so that the community in turn trusts them. And like with all these things, lots of different people will come in for whatever reasons that suit themselves. But where we are in our communities, we always say it's about two-way learning, you know, and our time frame is not the same as your time frame. You know, so and in lots of different ways, you know, if somebody else was to come into my community, their journey is probably to learn patience and to listen, because culture is about as much as what you do say as what you don't say. And, you know, and marginalized community, lots of different things happen, and a majority of people, you know, hypervigilant for whatever reason. So you really have to listen to what's not being said. So it's once again nuanced conversation,
right? And these are skills that are useful for any situation, in any case, in any life kind of relationship. But I appreciate that you make those points, Rachel. I have here a question from someone in the chat who talks about women writing in first person as men, and men writing as women, and they say that they've done this and are not very confident about it. This is for all three of you whoever wants to tackle that question.
Sorry, it's women writing about men or
women writing in the first person as men and men writing as women.
Oh look, it's a hard one. It depends on the skill of the writer and what they're trying to say, because I do have authors that have done that before as a male. They've written from a female perspective, and I've read it, and nothing has been outstanding in the sense that, you know, I've picked up on anything that doesn't necessarily need to be there, because it's also about the storytelling. And, you know, and maybe gender is also part of that technique as well. I've also read books about men writing as women, and I, once again, you know, when I've read it, haven't tripped over anything that doesn't, you know, necessarily doesn't need to be there. And I think also now we're in this space where we're talking about, you know, gender being non-binary in a sense. So it's kind of like that sort of feeds into that as well. And it's probably really just what the writer is very, very comfortable with in that sense. And if they are true to the art form and their craft in a sense, you know, so, and it, once again, it depends on the writer and their writing ability. Yeah.
I think getting feedback from your beta reader group about how that's sounding, I think that's really critically important. And, you know, my mother and my sister are my, you know, so get, you know, how does that sound? Does that sound authentic?
Yeah. Tim, I have to tell our audience about what I read in the acknowledgements, that you gave the manuscript to your mum to read and she said more sex.
She did. And I sent the whole manuscript back. It was longer than it ended up being to England. And the postman left it outside and it got soaking wet in the rain. And she basically had to peel the pages apart and dry them on the radiators. This was winter. And then she read through the whole thing and she just said, no, it needs more sex. It needs more sex. So I'm like, whoa, coming from my mother, that's something. And so I went back and I wrote more sex And my sister was horrified. So you can't pick all the people all the
Oh, that's a terrific story. But there you certainly got the female perspective on your book. Now, I've got actually I've got a question of my own for all three of you. In just thinking about back to writing these books that we discussed today, can you recall whether you faced any ethical dilemmas in the writing or the research for your stories? Indrani, would you like to start?
Yes, I was conscious that I might criticize other writers for stereotyping us, and I was could because I have English characters as well, and some of them are flat, and so I my way around it, I tried making them all complex and got completely lost in those. So I thought I'm going to have a range of characters who represent a range of types, and I did that for the Indians as well, because it was just except for the two main characters, and I think that worked because out of the blue I got a letter from a missionary who said she was friends with the Indians in 1940, you know, when it was going through its national movement, and her parents didn't really like what the British did, but she was quite glad I had different kinds of English. Some were they were a mix of the good, bad, and ugly. So yes, that was my, and I did the same for the Indians. The Indians are not all nice,
Of
and
course.
they're a mix of the good, the bad, and the ugly. But that was my way around it. Yes, I was very conscious of
Thank you.
that.
Rachel.
In regards to
Ethical dilemmas in the writing or research for your story.
The main thing that came about, I think, at the end was A, that I didn't represent that falsely that I had a, you know, a family member in the war and that I could talk to it because I couldn't, so I didn't. And one of the main things was later when we did send the manuscript off to the Australian War Memorial, the museum in Canberra. And there were some corrections, mainly to the illustrations as such. And to do with the flag at the time, and the response that was came back was, you need to get all of this stuff right because what will happen is the really serious historians will take umbrage in a children's picture book. You know, they'll drag the mistakes rather than listen to the story. So even in children's picture books, you know, making sure that ethically and historically you're correct was very important as well.
How about you, Tim?
Well, I think it's interesting that you know that the topic of unconscious bias and you know my hero is a Jewish survivor of the Spanish Inquisition, and the ethical dilemma was how do I represent that authentically, but also how do I not make it sound like an anti-Catholic tirade, and you know to represent characters from the other point of view sit sympathetically, and how do you do that when my characters' parents were burnt at the stake just for being who they were, and also when my character gets news of that, how do I then portray how he receives that news in an authentic way? But I guess my main dilemma, and looking back, was that I didn't want it to appear to be anti-Spanish or anti-Catholic, but I wanted to portray accurately what the events of that period were, so that the sort of you know broader themes about what this man stood for came through.
I think all of your answers to that question are interesting because I want our audience to get the sense that this is something that as writers we all struggle, we all have ethical dilemmas, and that you know there isn't a single way to work our way through them. I think it's quite interesting that Jenny in the chat has mentioned a comment to Indrani that she's reminded her that it's the humanity of our characters that is important. Some will be good, some will be bad, and some will be ugly. I think that's a terrific comment. Thank you, Jenny. Now, you know what? We really only have 3 minutes left now. I was crying wolf earlier, but there's a lovely question in the Q&A. There's a couple here, but we might only get to one. So Pip says, I'm interested in the idea of cultural appropriation and the dangers of this as discussed. I wonder whether when writing on universal themes such as Me Too, mental health, etc., whether sometimes introducing a historical viewpoint from a culture, e.g. immigrant experience, this can help discussion of themes as well as information about the culture. And in this instance, do you think there is less of an issue when the author is not of that culture, that obviously that, you know, research and collaboration is essential? Who'd like to go for that?
I think the topic of mental health is really important, and that people have been talking about these issues for a long time. It's not just something we've started talking about in the last, you know, 10, 20 years or so. And I think, again, it's about respectful research. But I think acknowledging that the people in historical context did talk about issues of mental health and post-traumatic stress disorder and addictions and other areas. So that's my little contribution.
Yeah, thank you. What about you, Rachel? Cultural appropriation and the dangers?
I you know, because I'm an Aboriginal person, I'm a publisher as well. I have to walk a fine line. I completely get literature, and I completely get the freedom of fiction. And creativity in arts and where that needs to be centred. But I'm also very aware of what we write and what we think have impact in the sense to broader community, and our thoughts become words, and our words on a piece of paper eventually can become legislation in lots of different ways. So
stop you there, Rachel, because we're seconds away from being cut off.
No, so, thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Rachel, Tim and Indrani for being with us today. It's been a fabulous discussion, and I hope to continue it again sometime in the future. Indrani, would you like to have the last word before we get cut off?
No, it's been really great looking at the commonalities of the viewpoints, regardless of what background, and also the differences.
Yes.
So really appreciate being able to be on the panel with all three of you.
Yes, it's been wonderful. Thank you, Tim and Indrani. And
it's been wonderful to get to know you, and thank you so much for the opportunity.
And our audience is sending a lot of love in the chat, if you want to have a quick look at that before we get cut off. Yeah. There is I think it's too late now to ask that last question because we're going to get cut off. So we'll stop here. Enjoy the rest of the conference.
Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, Summer Season 2023. Please remember to step back in time to our podcast archive, where you'll find interviews with many illuminary. Also, visit our website, hnsa.org.au, subscribe to our newsletter, and join our Facebook group to be effortlessly up to date with all that's hip and happening in historical fiction. I'm Greg Johnston. It's so good to have your company imagining the past.